New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Letter 10, Part 2 of A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Bird. Part 2 of Letter 10. Great Gorge of the Manitou, October 29th. This is a highly picturesque place, with several springs, still and effervescing, the virtues of which were well known to the Indians. Near it are places, the names of which are familiar to everyone: the Garden of the Gods, Glen Eyrie, Pike's Peak, Monument Park, and the Ute Pass. It has two or three immense hotels, and a few houses picturesquely situated. It is thronged by thousands of people in the summer, who come to drink the waters, try the camp cure, and make mountain excursions. But it is all quiet now, and there are only a few lingerers at this immense hotel. There is a rushing torrent in a valley, with mountains covered with snow and rising to a height of nearly 15,000 feet overhanging it. It is grand and awful, and has a strange, solemn beauty like death. And the snowy mountains are pierced by the torrent, which has excavated the Ute Pass, by which tomorrow I hope to go into the higher regions. But all may be lost for want of a horseshoe nail. One of Bertie's shoes is loose, and not a nail to be got here, or can be got till I have ridden for 10 miles up the pass. Bertie amuses everyone with her funny ways. She always follows me closely, and today got quite into a house and pushed the parlor door open. She walks after me with her head laid on my shoulder, licking my face and teasing me for sugar, and sometimes, when anyone else takes hold of her, she rears and kicks, and the vicious bronco soul comes into her eyes. Her face is cunning and pretty, and she makes a funny, blarneying noise when I go up to her. The men at all the stables make a fuss with her, and call her Pet. She gallops up and down hill, and never stumbles even on the roughest ground, or requires even a touch with a whip. The weather is again perfect, with a cloudless sky and a hot sun, and the snow is all off the plains and lower valleys. After lunch, the Blanks, in a buggy, and I on Bertie, left Colorado Springs, crossing the mesa, a high hill with a table top, with a view of extraordinary laminated rocks. Leaves of rock a bright vermilion color, against a background of snowy mountains, surmounted by Pike's Peak. Then we plunged into cavernous Glen Eyrie, with its fantastic needles of colored rock, and were entertained at General Palmer's baronial mansion, a perfect eyrie, the fine hall filled with buffalo, elk, and deer heads, skins of wild animals, stuffed birds, bear robes, and numerous Indian and other weapons and trophies. Then, through a gate of huge red rocks, we passed into the valley, called fantastically Garden of the Gods, in which, were I a divinity, I certainly would not choose to dwell. Many places in this neighborhood are also vulgarized by grotesque names. From this we passed into a ravine, down which the Fountain River rushed, and there I left my friends with regret, and rode into this chill and solemn gorge, from which the mountains, reddening in the sunset, are only seen afar off. I put Bertie up at a stable, and as there was no place to put myself up but this huge hotel, I came here to have a last taste of luxury. They charge $6 a day in the season, but it is now half price, and instead of 400 fashionable guests, there are only 15. most of whom are speaking in the weak, rapid accents of consumption and are coughing their hearts out. There are 7 medicinal springs. It is strange to have the luxuries of life in my room. It will be only the 4th night in Colorado that I have slept on anything better than hay or straw. I am glad that there are so few inns. As it is, I get a good deal of insight into the homes and modes of living of the settlers. Bergens Park, October 31st. This cabin was so dark, and I so sleepy last night, that I could not write. But the frost during the night has been very severe, and I am detained until the bright, hot sun melts the ice and renders traveling safe. I left the Great Manitou at 10 yesterday. Birdie, who was loose in the stable, came trotting down the middle of it when she saw me, for her sugar and biscuits. No nails could be got, and her shoe was hanging by 2, which doomed me to a foot's pace and a dismal clink of a loose shoe for 3 hours. There was not a cloud on the bright blue sky the whole day, and though it froze hard in the shade, it was summer heat in the sun. The mineral fountains were sparkling in their basins and sending up their full perennial jets, but the snow-clad, pine-skirted mountains frowned and darkened over the Ute Pass as I entered it to ascend it for 20 miles. A narrow pass it is, with barely room for the torrent and the wagon road, which has been blasted out of its steep sides. All the time I was in sight of the Fountain River, brighter than any stream, because it tumbles over rose-red granite, rocky or disintegrated, a truly fair stream, cutting and forcing its way through hard rocks, under arches of alabaster ice, through fringes of crystalline ice, thumping with a hollow sound in cavernous recesses, cold and dark, or leaping in foam from heights with rush and swish, always bright and riotous, never pausing in still pools to rest, dashing through gates of rock, pine-hung, pine-bridged, pine-buried, twinkling and laughing in the sunshine, or frowning in dowy dens in the blue-pine gloom, and there for a mile or two in a sheltered spot, owing to the more southern latitude, the everlasting northern pine met the trees of other climates. There were dwarf oaks, willows, hazel, and spruce. The white cedar and the trailing juniper jostles each other for a precarious foothold. The majestic redwood tree of the Pacific met the exquisite balsam pine of the Atlantic slopes, and among them all the pale gold foliage of the large aspen trembled, as the legend goes, in endless remorse. And above them towered the toothy peaks of the glittering mountains, rising in pure white against the sunny blue. Grand, glorious, sublime, but not lovable. I would give all for the luxurious redundance of one Hilo Gulch, or for one day of those soft, dreamy skies whose very tears are balm. Bergens Park. Up ever. The road being blasted out of the red rock, which often overhung it, the canyon only from 15 to 20 feet wide, the thunder of the fountain, which is crossed 8 times, nearly deafening. Sometimes the sun struck the road, and then it was absolutely hot. Then one entered unsunned gorges where the snow lay deep, and the crowded pines made dark twilight, and the river roared under ice bridges fringed with icicles. At last the pass opened out upon a sunlit upland park, where there was a forge, and with Birdie's shoe put on and some shoe nails in my purse, I rode on cheerfully, getting food for us both at a ranch belonging to some very pleasant people, who, like all Western folk, when they are not taciturn, asked a legion of questions. There I met a Colonel Kittredge, who said that he believed his valley, 12 miles off the track, to be the loveliest valley in Colorado, and invited me to his house. Leaving the road, I went up a long ascent deep in snow, but as it did not seem to be the way, I tied up the pony and walked on to a cabin at some distance, which I had hardly reached when I found her trotting like a dog by my side, pulling my sleeve and laying her soft gray nose on my shoulder. Does it all mean sugar? We had 8 miles farther to go, most of the way through a forest, which I always dislike when alone, from the fear of being frightened by something which may appear from behind a tree. I saw a beautiful white fox, several skunks, some chipmunks and gray squirrels, owls, crows, and crested blue jays. As the sun was getting low, I reached Bergen's Park, which was to put me out of conceit with Estes Park. Never. It is long and featureless, and its immediate surroundings are mean. It reminded me in itself of some dismal Highland strath, Glenshee possibly. I looked at it with special interest, as it was the place at which Miss Kingsley had suggested that I might remain. The evening was glorious, and the distant views were very fine. A stream, fringed with cottonwood, runs through the park. Low ranges come down upon it. The south end is completely closed up, but at a considerable distance, by the great mass of Pike's Peak, while far beyond the other end are peaks and towers, wonderful in blue and violet in the lovely evening. And beyond these, sharply defined against the clear green sky, was the serrated ridge of the Snowy Range, said to be 200 miles away. Bergen's Park had been bought by Dr. Bell, of London, but its present occupant is Mr. Thornton, an English gentleman who has a worthy married Englishman as his manager. Mr. Thornton is building a good house, and proposes to build other cabins, with the intention of making the park a resort for strangers. I thought of the Blue Hollow lying solitary at the foot of Long's Peak, and rejoiced that I had happened onto it. The cabin is long, low, mud-roofed, and very dark. The middle place is full of raw meat, fowls, and gear. One end, almost dark, contains the cooking stove, milk, crockery, a long deal table, 2 benches, and some wooden stools. The other end houses the English manager, or partner, his wife, and 3 children, another cooking stove, gear of all kinds, and sacks of beans and flowers. They put up a sheet for a partition, and made me a shakedown on the gravel floor of this room. 10 hired men sat down to meals with us. It was all very rough, dark, and comfortless, but Mr. T., who is not only a gentleman by birth, but an M.A. of Cambridge, seems to like it. Much in this way, a little smoother if a lady is in the case, every man must begin life here. 7 large dogs, 3 of them with cats upon their backs, are usually warming themselves by the fire. Twin Rock, South Fork of the Platte, November 1st. I did not leave Mr. Thornton's till 10, because of the slipperiness. I rode 4 miles along a back trail, and then was so tired that I stayed for 2 hours at a ranch, where I heard, to my dismay, that I must ride 24 miles farther before I could find any place to sleep at. I did not enjoy yesterday's ride. I was both tired and rheumatic, and Bertie was not so sprightly as usual. After starting again, I came on a hideous place, of which I had not heard before, Hayden's Divide, one of the great backbones of the region. A weary expanse of deep snow 11 miles across, and fearfully lonely. I saw nothing the whole way but a mule, lately dead, lying by the road. I was very nervous somehow, and towards evening believed that I had lost the road, for I came upon wild pine forest with huge masses of rock from 100 to 700 feet high, cast here and there among them. Beyond these, pine-sprinkled grass hills. These, in their turn, were bounded by interminable ranges, ghastly in the lurid evening, with the Spanish peaks quite clear, and the colossal summit of Mount Lincoln, the king of the Rocky Mountains, distinctly visible, though 70 miles away. It seemed awful to be alone on that ghastly ridge, surrounded by interminable mountains, in the deep snow, knowing that a party of 30 had been lost here a month ago. Just at nightfall, the descent of a steep hill took me out of the forest and upon a clean log cabin, where, finding that the proper halting place was 2 miles farther on, I remained. A truly pleasing, superior-looking woman placed me in a rocking-chair, would not let me help her otherwise than by rocking the cradle, and made me feel at home. The room, though it serves them and their two children for kitchen, parlor, and bedroom, is the pattern of brightness, cleanliness, and comfort. At supper there were canned raspberries, rolls, butter, tea, venison, and fried rabbit, and at 7 I went to bed in a carpeted log room, with a thick feather bed on a mattress, sheets, ruffled pillow slips, and a pile of warm, white blankets. I slept for 11 hours. They discouraged me much about the route which Governor Hunt had projected for me. They think that it is impassable, owing to the snow, and that another storm is brewing. Hall's Gulch, November 6th. I have ridden 150 miles since I wrote last. On leaving Twin Rock on Saturday, I had a short day's ride to Colonel Kittredge's cabin at Oil Creek, where I spent a quiet Sunday with agreeable people. The ride was all through parks and gorges and among pine-clothed hills about 9,000 feet high, with Pike's Peak always in sight. I have developed much sagacity in finding a trail, or I should not be able to make use of such directions as these. Keep along a gulch 4 or 5 miles till you get Pike's Peak on your left, then follow some wheel marks till you get to some timber, and keep to the north till you come to a creek, where you'll find a great many elk tracks. Then go to your right and cross the creek 3 times, then you'll see a red rock to your left, etc., etc. The Kay's cabin was very small and lonely, and the life seemed a hard grind for an educated and refined woman. There were snow flurries after I arrived, but the first Sunday of November was as bright and warm as June, and the atmosphere had resumed its exquisite purity. 3 peaks of Pike's Peak are seen from Oil Creek, above the nearer hills, and by them they tell the time. We had been in the evening shadows for 30 minutes before those peaks ceased to be transparent gold. On leaving Colonel Kittredge's hospitable cabin, I dismounted, as I had often done before, to lower a bar, and on looking round, Birdie was gone. I spent an hour in trying to catch her, but she had taken an ugly fit, and would not let me go near her, and I was getting tired and vexed, when 2 passing trappers, on mules, circumvented and caught her. I rode the 12 miles back to Twin Rock, and then went on, a kindly teamster, who was going in the same direction, taking my pack. I must explain that every mile I have traveled since leaving Colorado Springs has taken me farther and higher into the mountains. That afternoon I rode through lawn-like upland parks, with a great snow mass of Pike's Peak behind, and in front mountains bathed in rich atmospheric coloring of blue and violet, all very fine, but threatening to become monotonous, when the wagon road turned abruptly to the left and crossed a broad, swift mountain river, the headwaters of the Platte. There I found the ranch to which I had been recommended, the quarters of a great hunter named Link, which much resembled a good country inn. There was a pleasant, friendly woman, but the men were all away, a thing I always regret, as it gives me 30 minutes' work at the horse before I can write to you. I had hardly come in when a very pleasant German lady, whom I met at Manitou, with 3 gentlemen, arrived, and we were as sociable as people could be. We had a splendid, though rude, supper. While Mrs. Link was serving us, and urging her good things upon us, she was orating on the greediness of English people, saying that you would think they traveled through the country only to gratify their palates, and addressed me, asking me if I had not observed it. I am nearly always taken for a Dane or a Swede, never for an Englishwoman, so I often hear a good deal of outspoken criticism. In the evening Mr. Link returned, and there was a most vehement discussion between him, an old hunter, a miner, and the teamster who brought my pack, as to the route by which I should ride through the mountains for the next 3 or 4 days, because at that point I was to leave the wagon road, and it was renewed with increased violence the next morning, so that if my nerves had not been of steel, I should have been appalled. The old hunter acrimoniously said he must speak the truth. The miner was directing me over a track where for 25 miles there was not a house, and where, if snow came on, I should never be heard of again. The miner said he must speak the truth. The hunter was directing me over a pass where there were 5 feet of snow and no trail. The teamster said that the only road possible for a horse was so-and-so, and advised me to take the wagon road into South Park, which I was determined not to do. Mr. Link said he was the oldest hunter and settler in the district, and he could not cross any of the trails in snow. And so they went on. At last, they partially agreed on a route. The worst road in the Rocky Mountains, the old hunter said, with 2 feet of snow upon it. But a hunter had hauled an elk over part of it, at any rate. The upshot of the whole you shall have in my next letter. ILB. End of letter 10. Letter 11 of A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Bird. Letter 11. It was another cloudless morning, one of the many here on which one awakes early, refreshed, and ready to enjoy the fatigues of another day. In our sunless, misty climate, you do not know the influence which persistent fine weather exercises on the spirits. I have been 10 months in almost perpetual sunshine, and now a single, cloudy day makes me feel quite depressed. I did not leave till 9:30, because of the slipperiness, and shortly after starting, turned off into the wilderness on a very dim trail. Soon seeing a man riding a mile ahead, I rode on and overtook him, and we rode 8 miles together, which was convenient to me, as without him I should several times have lost the trail altogether. Then his fine American horse, on which he had only ridden 2 days, broke down, while my mad, bad bronco, on which I had been traveling for a fortnight, cantered lightly over the snow. He was the only traveler I saw in a day of nearly 12 hours. I thoroughly enjoyed every minute of that ride. I concentrated all my faculties of admiration and of locality, for truly the track was a difficult one. I sometimes thought it deserved the bad name given to it at links. For the most part, it keeps in sight of Terryall Creek, one of the large affluents of the Platte, and is walled in on both sides by mountains, which are sometimes so close together as to leave only the narrowest canyon between them, at others breaking wide apart, till after winding and climbing up and down for 25 miles, it lands one on a barren, rock-girdled park, watered by a rapid, fordable stream as broad as the Ouse at Huntingdon, snow-fed and ice-fringed, the park bordered by fantastic rocky hills, snow-covered and brightened only by a dwarf growth of the beautiful silver spruce. I have not seen anything hitherto so thoroughly wild and unlike the rest of these parts. I rode up one great ascent where hills were tumbled about confusedly, and suddenly across the broad ravine, rising above the sunny grass and the deep green pines, rose in glowing and shaded red against the glittering blue heaven, a magnificent and unearthly range of mountains, as shapely as could be seen, rising into colossal points, cleft by deep blue ravines, broken up into shark's teeth, with gigantic knobs and pinnacles rising from their inaccessible sides, very fair to look upon. A glowing, heavenly, unforgettable sight, and only 4 miles off. Mountains, they looked not of this earth, but such as one sees in dreams alone, the blessed ranges of the land which is very far off. They were more brilliant than those incredible colors in which painters array the fiery hills of Moab and the desert, and one could not believe them forever uninhabited, for on them rose, as in the east, the similitude of stately fortresses, not the gray castellated towers of feudal Europe, but gay, massive, Saracenic architecture, the outgrowth of the solid rock. They were vast ranges, apparently of enormous height, their color indescribable, deepest and reddest near the pine-draped bases, then gradually softening into wonderful tenderness, till the highest summits rose all flushed, and with an illusion of transparency, so that one might believe that they were taking on the hue of sunset. Below them lay broken ravines of fantastic rocks, cleft and canyoned by the river, with a tender, unearthly light over all, the apparent warmth of a glowing clime, while I on the north side was in the shadow among the pure, unsullied snow. With us the damp, the chill, the gloom. With them the sunset's rosy bloom. The dimness of earth with me, the light of heaven with them. Here again worship seemed the only attitude for a human spirit, and the question was ever present. Lord, what is man, that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man, that thou visitest him? I rode up and down hills laboriously in snowdrifts, getting off often to ease my faithful birdie by walking down ice-clad slopes, stopping constantly to feast my eyes upon that changeless glory, always seeing some new ravine, with its depths of color or miraculous brilliancy of red, or fantasy of form. Then below, where the trail was locked into a deep canyon, where there was scarcely room for it and the river, there was a beauty of another kind in solemn gloom. There the stream curved and twisted marvelously, widening into shallows, narrowing into deep boiling eddies, with pyramidal firs and the beautiful silver spruce fringing its banks, and often falling across it in artistic grace, the gloom chill and deep, with only now and then a light trickling through the pines upon the cold snow, when suddenly turning round, I saw behind, as if in the glory of an eternal sunset, those flaming and fantastic peaks. The effect of the combination of winter and summer was singular. The trail ran on the north side the whole time, and the snow lay deep and pure white, while not a wreath of it lay on the south side, where abundant lawns basked in the warm sun. The pitch pine, with its monotonous and somewhat rigid form, had disappeared. The white pine became scarce, both being displayed by the slim spires and silvery green of the miniature silver spruce. Valley and canyon were passed, the flaming ranges were left behind, the upper altitudes became grim and mysterious. I crossed a lake on the ice, and then came on a park surrounded by barren, contorted hills, overtopped by snow mountains. There, in some brushwood, we crossed a deepish stream on the ice, which gave way, and the fearful cold of the water stiffened my limbs for the rest of the ride. All these streams become bigger as you draw nearer to their source, and shortly the trail disappeared in a broad, rapid river, which we forded twice. The trail was very difficult to recover. It ascended ever in frost and snow, amidst scanty timber dwarfed by cold and twisted by storms, amidst solitudes such as one reads of in the high Alps. There were no sounds to be heard but the crackle of ice and snow, the pitiful howling of wolves, and the hoot of owls. The sun to me had long set. The peaks which had blushed were pale and sad. The twilight deepened into green, but still excelsior. There were no happy homes with light of household fires. Above, the spectral mountains lifted their cold summits. As darkness came on, I began to fear that I had confused the cabin to which I had been directed with the rocks. To confess the truth, I was cold, for my boots and stockings had frozen on my feet, and I was hungry, too, having eaten nothing but raisins for 14 hours. After riding 30 miles, I saw a light a little way from the track, and found it to be the cabin of the daughter of the pleasant people with whom I had spent the previous night. Her husband had gone to the plains, yet she, with two infant children, was living there in perfect security. Two peddlers, who were peddling their way down from the mines, came in for a night's shelter soon after I arrived, ill-looking fellows enough. They admired Bertie in a suspicious fashion, and offered to swap their pack horse for her. I went out the last thing at night, and the first thing in the morning to see that the pony was safe, for they were very importunate on the subject of the swap. I had before been offered $150 for her. I was obliged to sleep with the mother and children, and the peddlers occupied a room within ours. It was hot and airless. The cabin was papered with the Phrenological Journal, and in the morning I opened my eyes on the very best portrait of Dr. Candlish I ever saw, and grieved truly that I should never see that massive brow and fantastic face again. Mrs. Link was an educated and very intelligent young woman. The peddlers were Irish Yankees, and the way in which they traded was as amusing as Sam Slick. They not only wanted to swap my pony, but to trade my watch. They trade their souls, I know. They displayed their wares for an hour with much dexterous flattery and persuasiveness. But Mrs. Link was untemptable, and I was only tempted into buying a handkerchief to keep the sun off. There was another dispute about my route. It was the most critical day of my journey. If a snowstorm came on, I might be detained in the mountains for many weeks. But if I got through the snow and reached the Denver wagon road, no detention would signify much. The peddlers insisted that I could not get through, for the road was not broken. Mrs. L. thought I could, and advised me to try. So I saddled Bertie and rode away. More than half of the day was far from enjoyable. The morning was magnificent, but the light too dazzling, the sun too fierce. As soon as I got out, I felt as if I should drop off the horse. My large handkerchief kept the sun from my neck, but the fierce heat caused soul and sense, brain and eye, to reel. I never saw or felt the like of it. I was at a height of 12,000 feet, where, of course, the air was highly rarefied, and the snow was so pure and dazzling that I was obliged to keep my eyes shut as much as possible to avoid snow blindness. The sky was a different and terribly fierce color, and when I caught a glimpse of the sun, he was white and unwinking like a lime-ball light, yet threw off wicked scintillations. I suffered so from nausea, exhaustion, and pains from head to foot that I felt as if I must lie down in the snow. It may have been partly to the early stage of soroche, or mountain sickness. We plodded on for 4 hours, snow all around, and nothing else to be seen but an ocean of glistening peaks against the sky of infuriated blue. How I found my way, I shall never know, for the only marks on the snow were occasional footprints of a man, and I had no means of knowing whether they led in the direction I ought to take. Earlier, before the snow became so deep, I passed the last great haunt of the magnificent mountain bison, but unfortunately saw nothing but horns and bones. 2 months ago, Mr. Link succeeded in separating a calf from the herd and has partially domesticated it. It is a very ugly thing at 7 months old, with a thick beard and a short, thick, dark mane on its heavy shoulders. It makes a loud grunt like a pig. It can outrun their fastest horse, and it sometimes leaps over the high fence of the corral and takes all the milk of the 5 cows. The snow grew seriously deep. Bertie fell 30 times, I am sure. She seemed unable to keep up at all, so I was obliged to get off and stumble along in her footmarks. By that time, my spirit for overcoming difficulties had somewhat returned, for I saw a lie of country which I knew must contain South Park, and we had got under cover of a hill which kept off the sun. The trail had ceased. It was only one of those hunter's tracks which continually misled one. The getting through the snow was awful work. I think we accomplished a mile in something over 2 hours. The snow was 2 feet 8 inches deep, and once we went down in a drift, the surface of which was rippled like sea sand, Bertie up to her back, and I up to my shoulders. At last we got through, and I beheld, with some sadness, the goal of my journey. The Great Divide, the Snowy Range, and between me and it South Park. A rolling prairie 75 miles long and over 10,000 feet high, treeless, bounded by mountains, and so rich in sun-cured hay that one might find fancy that all the herds of Colorado could find pasture there. Its chief center is the rough mining town of Fair Play, but there are rumors of great mineral wealth in various quarters. The region has been rushed, and mining camps have risen at Alma and elsewhere, so lawless and brutal that vigilance committees are forming as a matter of necessity. South Park is closed, or nearly so, by snow during the ordinary winter, and just now the great freight wagons are carrying up the last supplies of the season and taking down women and other temporary inhabitants. A great many people come up here in the summer. The rarefied air produces great oppression on the lungs, accompanied with bleeding. It is said that you can tell a new arrival by seeing him go about holding a blood-stained handkerchief to his mouth. But I came down upon it from regions of ice and snow, and the snow which had fallen on it had all disappeared by evaporation and drifting. It looked to me quite lowland and livable, though lonely and indescribably mournful. A silent sea, suggestive of the muffled oar. I cantered across the narrow end of it, delighted to have got through the snow, and when I struck the Denver stage road, I supposed that all the difficulties of mountain travel were at an end. But this has not turned out to be exactly the case. A horseman shortly joined me and rode with me, got me a fresh horse, and accompanied me for 10 miles. He was a picturesque figure and rode a very good horse. He wore a big slouch hat, from under which a number of fair curls hung nearly to his waist. His beard was fair, his eyes blue, and his complexion ruddy. There was nothing sinister in his expression, and his manner was respectful and frank. He was dressed in a hunter's buckskin suit, ornamented with beads, and wore a pair of exceptionally big brass spurs. His saddle was very highly ornamented. What was unusual was the number of weapons he carried. Besides a rifle, laid across his saddle, and a pair of pistols in the holsters, he carried two revolvers and a knife in his belt, and a carbine slung behind him. I found him what is termed good company. He told me a great deal about the country and its wild animals, with some hunting adventures, and a great deal about Indians and their cruelty and treachery. All this time, having crossed South Park, we were ascending the Continental Divide by what I think is termed the Breckenridge Pass on a fairly good wagon road. We stopped at a cabin, where the woman seemed to know my companion, and, in addition to bread and milk, produced some venison steaks. We rode on again and reached the crest of the divide, and saw snow-born streams starting within a quarter of a mile from each other, one for the Colorado and the Pacific, the other for the Platte and the Atlantic. Here I wished the hunter good-bye, and reluctantly turned northeast. It was not wise to go up the divide at all, and it was necessary to do it in haste. On my way down, I spoke to the woman at whose cabin I had dined, and she said, "I am sure you found Comanche Bill a real gentleman." And I then knew that, if she gave me correct information, my intelligent, courteous companion was one of the most notorious desperadoes of the Rocky Mountains, and the greatest Indian exterminator on the frontier. A man whose father and family fell in a massacre at Spirit Lake by the hands of Indians, who carried away his sister, then a child of 11. His life has since been mainly devoted to a search for this child, and to killing Indians wherever he can find them. After riding 20 miles, which made the distance for that day 50, I remounted Birdie to ride 6 miles farther, to a house which had been mentioned to me as a stopping place. The road ascended to a height of 11,000 feet, and from thence I looked my last at the lonely, uplifted prairie sea. Denver Stage Road, the worst, rudest, dismallest, dark road I have ever yet traveled on, nothing but a winding ravine. The Platte Canyon, pine-crowded and pine-darkened, walled in on both sides for 6 miles by pine-skirted mountains 12,000 feet high. Along this abyss for 50 miles there are said to be only 5 houses, and were it not for miners going down and freight wagons going up, the solitude would be awful. As it was, I did not see a creature. It was 4 when I left South Park, and between those mountain walls and under the pines it soon became quite dark, a darkness which could be felt. The snow which had melted in the sun had refrozen, and was one sheet of smooth ice. Birdie slipped so alarmingly that I got off and walked, but then neither of us could keep our feet, and in the darkness she seemed so likely to fall upon me that I took out of my pack the man's socks which had been given me at Perry's Park, and drew them on over her forefeet. An expedient which for a time succeeded admirably, and which I commend to all travelers similarly circumstanced. It was unutterably dark, and all these operations had to be performed by the sense of touch only. I remounted, allowed her to take her own way, as I could not even see her ears, and though her hind legs slipped badly, we contrived to get along through the narrowest part of the canyon, with a tumbling river close to the road. The pines were very dense, and sighed and creaked mournfully in the severe frost, and there were other eerie noises not easy to explain. At last, when the socks were nearly worn out, I saw the blaze of a campfire, with 2 hunters sitting by it on the hillside, and at the mouth of a gulch something which looked like buildings. We got across the river partly on ice and partly by fording, and I found that this was the place where, in spite of its somewhat dubious reputation, I had been told that I could put up. A man came out in the sapient and good-natured stage of intoxication, and the door being opened, I was confronted by a rough bar and a smoking, blazing kerosene lamp without a chimney. This is the worst place I have put up at as to food, lodging, and general character. An old and very dirty log cabin, not chinked, with 1 dingy room used for cooking and feeding, in which a miner was lying very ill of fever. Then a large roofless shed with a canvas side, which is to be an addition, and then the bar. They accounted for the disorder by the building operations. They asked me if I were the English lady written of in the Denver News, and for once I was glad that my fame had preceded me, as it seemed to secure me against being quietly put out of the way. A horrible meal was served, dirty, greasy, disgusting. A celebrated hunter, Bob Craik, came in to supper with a young man in tow, whom, in spite of his rough hunter's or miner's dress, I at once recognized as an English gentleman. It was their campfire which I had seen on the hillside. This gentleman was lording it in true caricature fashion, with a Lord Dundreary drawl and a general execration of everything. While I sat in the chimney corner, speculating on the reason why many of the upper class of my countrymen, high-toners, as they are called out here, make themselves so ludicrously absurd. They neither know how to hold their tongues or to carry their personal pretensions. An American is naturally assumptive, an Englishman personally so. He took no notice of me till something passed which showed him I was English, when his manner at once changed into courtesy, and his drawl was shortened by a half. He took pains to let me know that he was an officer in the Guards, of good family, on 4 months' leave, which he was spending in slaying buffalo and elk, and also that he had a profound contempt for everything American. I cannot think why Englishmen put on these broad, mouthing tones, and give so many personal details. They retired to their camp, and the landlord, having passed into the sodden, sleepy stage of drunkenness, his wife asked if I should be afraid to sleep in the large, canvas-sided, unceiled, doorless shed, as they could not move the sick miner. So I slept there on a shakedown, with the stars winking overhead through the roof, and the mercury showing 30 degrees of frost. I never told you that I once gave an unwary promise that I would not travel alone in Colorado unarmed, and that in consequence I left Estes Park with a Sharp's revolver, loaded with ball cartridge, in my pocket, which has been the plague of my life. Its bright, ominous barrel peeped out in quiet Denver shops. Children pulled it out to play with, or when my riding dress hung up with it in the pocket, pulled the whole from the peg to the floor. And I cannot conceive of any circumstances in which I could feel it right to make any use of it, or in which it could do me any possible good. Last night, however, I took it out, cleaned and oiled it, and laid it under my pillow, resolving to keep awake all night. I slept as soon as I lay down, and never woke till the bright morning sun shone through the roof, making me ridicule my own fears and abjure pistols forever. ILB. End of letter 11. Letter 12 of A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Bird. Letter 12. Dear Valley, November. Tonight I am in a beautiful place, like a Dutch farm. Large, warm, bright, clean, with abundance of clean food and a clean, cold little bedroom to myself. But it is very hard to write, for two free-tongued, noisy Irish women who keep a miner's boarding-house in South Park and are going to winter quarters in a freight wagon are telling the most fearful stories of violence, vigilance committees, lynch law, and stringing that I ever heard. It turns one's blood cold only to think that where I travel in perfect security, only a short time ago men were being shot like skunks. At the mining towns up above this, nobody is thought anything of who has not killed a man. That is a certain set. These women had a boarder, only 15, who thought he could not be anything till he had shot somebody, and they gave an absurd account of the lad dodging about with a revolver and not getting up courage enough to insult anyone, till at last he hid himself in the stable and shot the first Chinaman who entered. Things up there are just in that initial state which desperadoes love. A man accidentally shoves another in a saloon, or says a rough word at meals, and the challenge, first finger on the trigger, warrants either in shooting the other at any subsequent time without the formality of a duel. Nearly all the shooting affrays arise from the most trivial causes in saloons and barrooms. The deeper quarrels, arising from jealousy or revenge, are few, and are usually about some woman not worth fighting for. At Alma and Fair Play, vigilance committees have been lately formed, and when men act outrageously and make themselves generally obnoxious, they receive a letter with the drawing of a tree, a man hanging from it, and a coffin below, on which is written, "Forewarned." They get in a few hours. When I said I spent last night at Hall's Gulch, there was quite a chorus of exclamations. My host there, they all said, would be strung before long. Did I know that a man was strung there yesterday? Had I not seen him hanging? He was on the big tree by the house, they said. Certainly, had I known what a ghastly burden that tree bore, I would have encountered the ice and gloom of the gulch rather than have slept there. They then told me a horrid tale of crime and violence. This man had even shocked the morals of the Alma crowd, and had a notice served on him by the vigilance, which had the desired effect, and he migrated to Hall's Gulch. As the tale runs, the Hall's Gulch miners were resolved either not to have a groggery or to limit the number of such places, and when this ruffian set one up, he was forewarned. It seems, however, to have been merely a pretext for getting rid of him, for it was hardly a crime of which even lynch law could take cognizance. He was overpowered by numbers, and with circumstances of great horror, was tried and strung on that tree within an hour. Beginning of footnote. Public opinion approved this execution, regarding it as a fitting retribution for a series of crimes. End of footnote. I left the place this morning at 10, and have had a very pleasant day, for the hills shut out the hot sun. I only rode 22 miles, for the difficulty of riding on ice was great, and there is no blacksmith within 35 miles of Hall's Gulch. I met two freighters just after I left, who gave me the unwelcome news that there were 30 miles of ice between that and Denver. "You'll have a tough trip," they said. The road runs up and down hill, walled in along with a rushing river by high mountains. The scenery is very grand, but I hate being shut into these deep gorges, and always expect to see some startling object moving among the trees. I met no one the whole day after passing the teams except two men with a pack-jack. Bertie hates jacks, and rears and shies as soon as she sees one. It was a bad road, one shelving sheet of ice, and awfully lonely, and between the peril of the mare breaking her leg on the ice and that of being crushed by windfalls of timber, I had to look out all day. Toward sunset I came to a cabin where they keep travelers, but the woman looked so vinegar-faced that I preferred to ride 4 miles farther, up a beautiful road winding along a sunny gulch filled with silver spruce, bluer and more silvery than any I have yet seen, and then crossed a divide, from which the view in all the ecstasy of sunset color was perfectly glorious. It was enjoyment also in itself to get out of the deep chasm in which I had been immured all day. There is a train of 12 freight wagons here, each wagon with 6 horses, but the teamsters carry their own camping blankets and sleep either in their wagons or on the floor, so the house is not crowded. It is a pleasant 2-story log house, not only chinked, but lined with planed timber. Each room has a great open chimney with logs burning in it. There are pretty engravings on the walls, and baskets full of creepers hanging from the ceiling. This is the first settler's house I have been in which the ornamental has had any place. There is a door to each room. The oak chairs are bright with rubbing, and the floor, though unplaned, is so clean that one might eat off it. The table is clean and abundant, and the mother and daughter, though they do all the work, look as trim as if they did none, and actually laugh heartily. The ranchman neither allows drink to be brought into the house nor to be drunk outside, and on this condition only he keeps travelers. The freighters come in to supper quite well washed, and though 12 of them slept in the kitchen, by 9 o'clock there was not a sound. This freighting business is most profitable. I think that the charge is 3 cents per pound from Denver to South Park, and there much of the freight is transferred to packjacks and carried up to the mines. A railroad, however, is contemplated. I breakfasted with the family after the freight train left, and instead of sitting down to gobble up the remains of a meal, they had a fresh tablecloth and hot food. The buckets are all polished oak, with polished brass bands. The kitchen utensils are bright as rubbing can make them. And more wonderful still, the girls black their boots. Blacking usually is an unused luxury, and frequently is not kept in houses. My boots have only been blacked once during the last 2 months. Denver, November 9th. I could not make out whether the superiority of the Deer Valley settlers extended beyond material things, but a teamster I met in the evening said it made him more of a man to spend a night in such a house. In Colorado, whiskey is significant of all evil and violence and is the cause of most of the shooting affrays in the mining camps. There are few moderate drinkers. It is seldom taken except to excess. The great local question in the territory, and just now the great electoral issue, is drink or no drink, and some of the papers are openly advocating a prohibitive liquor law. Some of the districts, such as Greeley, in which liquor is prohibited, are without crime, and in several of the stock-raising and agricultural regions through which I have traveled, where it is practically excluded, the doors are never locked, and the miners leave their silver bricks in their wagons, unprotected at night. People say that on coming from the eastern states, they hardly realize at first the security in which they live. There is no danger and no fear. But the truth of the proverbial saying, "There is no God west of the Missouri" is everywhere manifest. The almighty dollar is the true divinity, and its worship is universal. Smartness is the quality thought most of. The boy who gets on by cheating at his lessons is praised for being a smart boy, and his satisfied parents foretell that he will make a smart man. A man who overreaches his neighbor, but who does it so cleverly that the law cannot take hold of him, wins an envied reputation as a smart man. And stories of this species of smartness are told admiringly round every stove. Smartness is but the initial stage of swindling, and the clever swindler who evades or defines the weak and often corruptly administered laws of the states excites unmeasured admiration among the masses. Beginning of footnote. May, 1878. I am copying this letter in the city of San Francisco, and regretfully add a strong emphasis to what I have written above. The best and most thoughtful among Americans would endorse these remarks with shame and pain. ILB. End of footnote. I left Deer Valley at 10 the next morning on a glorious day, with rich atmospheric coloring. Had to spend 3 hours sitting on a barrel in a forge after I had ridden 12 miles, waiting while 24 oxen were shod, and then rode on 23 miles through streams and canyons of great beauty till I reached a grocery store, where I had to share a room with a large family and 3 teamsters, and being almost suffocated by the curtain partition, got up at 4, before anyone was stirring, saddled Birdie, and rode away in the darkness, leaving my money on the table. It was a short 18 miles ride to Denver, down the Turkey Creek Canyon, which contains some magnificent scenery, and then the road ascends and hangs on the ledge of a precipice 600 feet in depth. Such a narrow road that on meeting a wagon I had to dismount for fear of hurting my feet with the wheels. From thence there was a wonderful view through the rolling foothills and over the gray-brown plains to Denver. Not a tree or shrub was to be seen. Everything was rioting in summer heat and drought, while behind lay the last Grand Canyon of the mountains, dark with pines and cool with snow. I left the track and took a short cut over the prairie to Denver, passing through an encampment of the Ute Indians, about 500 strong, a disorderly and dirty huddle of lodges, ponies, men, squaws, children, skins, bones, and raw meat. The Americans will never solve the Indian problem till the Indian is extinct. They have treated them after a fashion which has intensified their treachery and devilry, as enemies and as friends, reduces them to a degraded pauperism, devoid of the very first elements of civilization. The only difference between the savage and the civilized Indian is that the latter carries firearms and gets drunk on whiskey. The Indian agency has been a sink of fraud and corruption. It is said that barely 30% of the allowance ever reaches those for whom it is voted, and the complaints of shoddy blankets, damaged flour, and worthless firearms are universal. To get rid of the Indians is the phrase used everywhere. Even their reservations do not escape seizure practically, for if gold breaks out on them, they are rushed, and their possessors are either compelled to accept land farther west or are shot off and driven off. One of the surest agents in their destruction is vitriolized whiskey. An attempt has recently been made to cleanse the Augean stable of the Indian Department, but it has met with signal failure, the usual result in America of every effort to purify the official atmosphere. Americans specially love superlatives. The phrases, biggest in the world, finest in the world, are on all lips. Unless President Hayes is a strong man, they will soon come to boast that their government is composed of the biggest scoundrels in the world. As I rode into Denver and away from the mountains, the view became glorious, as range above range, crowned with snow, came into sight. I was sure that 3 glistening peaks, 70 miles north, were the peerless shapeliness of Long's Peak, the king of the Rocky Mountains, and the mountain fever returned so severely that I grudged every hour spent on the hot, dry plains. The range looked lovelier and sublimer than when I first saw it from Greeley, all spiritualized in the wonderful atmosphere. I went direct to Evans' house, where I found a hearty welcome, as they had been anxious about my safety, and Evans almost at once arrived from Estes Park with three elk, one grizzly, and one bighorn in his wagon. Regarding a place and life one likes, in spite of all lessons, one is sure to think, tomorrow shall be as this day, and much more abundant. And all through my tour I had thought of returning to Estes Park and finding everything just as it was. Evans brought the unwelcome news that the goodly fellowship was broken up. The Deweys and Mr. Waller were in Denver, and the house was dismantled, Mr. and Mrs. Edwards alone remaining, who were, however, expecting me back. Saturday, though like a blazing summer day, was wonderful in its beauty, and after sunset the afterglow was richer and redder than I had ever seen it. But the heavy crimson betokened severe heat, which came on yesterday, and was hardly bearable. I attended service twice at the Episcopal Church, where the service was beautifully read and sung. But in a city in which men preponderate, the congregation was mainly composed of women, who fluttered their fans in a truly distracting way. Except for the church-going, there were few perceptible signs of Sunday in Denver, which was full of rowdies from the mountain mining camps. You can hardly imagine the delight of joining in those grand old prayers after so long a deprivation. The Te Deum sounded heavenly in its magnificence, but the heat was so tremendous that it was hard to warstle through the day. They say that they have similar outbreaks of solar fury all through the winter. Golden City, November 13th. Pleasant as Denver was, with the Deweys and so many kind friends there, it was too much of the wearying world, either for my health or taste, and I left for my 16 miles ride to this place at 4 on Monday afternoon, with the sun still hot. Passing by a bare, desolate-looking cemetery, I asked a sad-looking woman who was leaning on the gate if she could direct me to the Golden City. I repeated the question twice before I got an answer, and then, though easily to be accounted for, it was wide of the mark. In most doleful tones, she said, "Oh, go to the minister. I might tell you, maybe, but it's too great a responsibility. Go to the ministers. They can tell you." And she returned to her tears for someone whose spirit she was doubtless thinking of as in the Golden City of our hopes. The 16 miles seemed like 1 mile after sunset, in the rapturous freshness of the Colorado air, and Birdie, after her 2 days' rest and with a lightened load, galloped across the prairie as if she enjoyed it. I did not reach this gorge till late, and it was an hour after dark before I groped my way into this dark, unlighted mining town, where, however, we were most fortunate, both as to stable and accommodation for myself. Boulder, November 16th. I fear you will grow tired of the details of these journal letters. To a person sitting quietly at home, Rocky Mountain traveling, like Rocky Mountain scenery, must seem very monotonous. But not so to me, to whom the pure, dry mountain air is the elixir of life. At Golden City I parted for a time from my faithful pony, as Clear Creek Canyon, which leads from it to Idaho, is entirely monopolized by a narrow-gauge railroad, and is inaccessible for horses and mules. To be without a horse in these mountains is to be reduced to complete helplessness. My great wish was to see Green Lake, situated near the timber line above Georgetown, said to be the highest town in the United States, at a height of 9,000 feet. A single day took me from the heat of summer into the intense cold of winter. Golden City by daylight showed its meanness and belied its name. It is ungraded, with here and there a piece of wooden sidewalk, supported on post, up to which you ascend by planks. Brick, pine, and log houses are huddled together. Every other house is a saloon, and hardly a woman is to be seen. My landlady apologized for the very exquisite little bedroom which she gave me by saying it was not quite as she would like it, but she had never had a lady in her house before. The young lady who waited at breakfast said, "I've been thinking about you, and I'm certain sure you're an authoress." The day, as usual, was glorious. Think of November half through, and scarcely even a cloud in the sky, except the vermilion cloudlets which accompany the sky at his rising and setting. They say that winter never sets in there in the foothills, but that there are spells of cold, alternating with bright, hot weather, and that the snow never lies on the ground so as to interfere with the feed of the cattle. Golden City rang with oaths and curses, especially at the depot. Americans are given over to the most atrocious swearing, and the blasphemous use of our Savior's name is peculiarly revolting. Golden City stands at the mouth of Tufkus, otherwise Clear Creek Canyon, which many people think the grandest scenery in the mountains, as it twists and turns marvelously, and its stupendous sides are nearly perpendicular, while farther progress is to all appearance continually blocked by great masses of rock and piles of snow-covered mountains. Unfortunately, its sides have been almost entirely denuded of timber, mining operations consuming any quantity of it. The narrow-gauge, steel-grade railroad, which runs up the canyon for the convenience of the rich mining districts of Georgetown, Black Hawk, and Central City, is a curiosity of engineering. The track has partly been blasted out of the sides of the canyon, and has partly been built by making a bed of stones in the creek itself, and laying the track across them. I have never seen such churlishness and incivility as in the officials of that railroad, and the state lines which connect with it, or met with such preposterous charges. They have handsome little cars on the route, but though the passengers paid full fare, they put us into a baggage car because the season was over, and in order to see anything, I was obliged to sit on the floor at the door. The singular grandeur cannot be described. It is a mere gash cut by the torrent, twisted, walled, chasmed, weather-stained with the most brilliant coloring, generally dark with shadow, but its utter desolation occasionally revealed by a beam of intense sunshine. A few stunted pines and cedars, spared because of their inaccessibility, hung here and there out of the rifts. Sometimes the walls of the abyss seemed to meet overhead, and then widening out, the rocks assumed fantastic forms, all grandeur, sublimity, and almost terror. After 2 hours of this, the track came to an end, and the canyon widened sufficiently for a road, all stones, holes, and sidings. There a great Concord coach waited for us, intended for 20 passengers, and a mountain of luggage in addition, and the four passengers without any luggage sat on the seat behind the driver, so that the huge thing bounced and swung upon the straps on which it was hung, so as to recall the worst horrors of New Zealand staging. The driver never spoke without an oath, and though two ladies were passengers, cursed his splendid horses the whole time. Formerly, even the most profane men intermitted their profanity in the presence of women, but they have changed all that. Everyone I saw up there seemed in a bad temper. I suspect that all their smart tricks in mining and shares had gone wrong. The road pursued the canyon to Idaho Springs, a fashionable mountain resort in the summer, but deserted now, where we took a superb team of 6 horses, with which we attained a height of 10,000 feet, and then a descent of 1,000 took us into Georgetown, crowded into as remarkable a gorge as was ever selected for the site of a town, the canyon beyond apparently terminating into precipitous and inaccessible mountains, sprinkled with pines up to the timberline, and thinly covered with snow. The area on which it is possible to build is so circumcised and steep, and the unpainted gable-ended houses are so perched here and there, and the water rushes so impetuously among them, that it reminded me slightly of a Swiss town. All the smaller houses are shored up with young pines on one side to prevent them from being blown away by the fierce gusts which sweep the canyon. It is the only town I have seen in America to which the epithet picturesque could be applied. But truly, seated in that deep hollow in the cold and darkness, it is in a terrible situation, with the alpine heights towering round it. I arrived at 3, but its sun had set, and it lay in deep shadow. In fact, twilight seemed coming on, and as I had been unable to get my circular notes cashed at Denver, I had no money to stay over the next day, and much feared that I should lose Green Lake, the goal of my journey. We drove through the narrow, piled-up, irregular street, crowded with miners standing in groups, or drinking and gaming under the verandas, to a good hotel declivitously situated, where I at once inquired if I could get to Green Lake. The landlord said he thought not. The snow was very deep, and no one had been up for 5 weeks, but for my satisfaction he would send to a stable and inquire. The amusing answer came back. If it's the English lady traveling in the mountains, she can have a horse, but not anyone else. End of letter 12. Letter 13 of A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Bird. Letter 13. Boulder, November. The answer regarding a horse at the end of my former letter was given to the landlord outside the hotel, and presently he came in and asked my name and if I were the lady who had crossed from Lynx to South Park by Terryall Creek. So news travels fast. In 5 minutes the horse was at the door, with a clumsy, two-horned side saddle, and I started at once for the upper regions. It was an exciting ride, much spiced with apprehension. The evening shadows had darkened over Georgetown, and I had 2,000 feet to climb, or give up Green Lake. I shall forget many things, but never the awfulness and hugeness of the scenery. I went up a steep track by Clear Creek, then a succession of frozen waterfalls in a widened and then narrowed valley, whose frozen sides looked 5,000 feet high. That is the region of enormous mineral wealth in silver. There are the Terrible and other mines whose shares you can see quoted daily in the share list in the Times, sometimes at cent per cent premium, and then down to 25 discount. These mines, with their prolonged subterranean workings, their stamping and crushing mills, and the smelting works which have been established near them, fill the district with noise, hubbub, and smoke by day and night. But I had turned altogether aside from them into a still region, where each miner in solitude was grubbing for himself, and confiding to none his finds or disappointments. Agriculture restores and beautifies, mining destroys and devastates, turning the earth inside out, making it hideous, and blighting every green thing, as it usually blights man's heart and soul. There was mining everywhere along the Grand Road, with all its destruction and devastation, its digging, burrowing, gulching, and sluicing, and up all along the seemingly inaccessible heights were holes with their roofs log-supported, in which solitary and patient men were selling their lives for treasure. Down by the stream, all among the icicles, men were sluicing and washing, and everywhere along the heights were the scars of hardly passable trails, too steep even for packjacks, leading to the holes, and down which the miner packs the ore on his back. Many a heart has been broken for the few finds which have been made along those hillsides. All the ledges are covered with charred stumps, a picture of desolation, where nature had made everything grand and fair. But even from all this I turned. The last miner I saw gave me explicit directions, and I left the track and struck upwards into the icy solitudes. Sheets of ice at first, then snow, over a foot deep, pure and powdery. Then a very difficult ascent through a pine forest, where it was nearly dark, the horse tumbling about in deep snowdrifts. But the goal was reached, and none too soon. At a height of nearly 12,000 feet, I halted on a steep declivity, and below me, completely girdled by dense forest of pines, with mountains red and glorified in the sunset rising above them, was Green Lake, looking like water, but in reality a sheet of ice 2 feet thick. From the gloom and chill below, I had come up into the pure air and sunset light, and the glory of the unprofaned works of God. It brought to my mind the verse, "The darkness is past, and true light now shineth." And, as if in commentary upon it, were the hundreds and thousands of men delving in dark holes in the gloom of the twilight below. O earth, so full of dreary noises! O men, with wailing in your voices! O delved gold, the wailer's heap! God strikes a silence through you all. He giveth his beloved sleep. It was something to reach that height and see the far-off glory of the sunset, and by it to be reminded that neither God nor his Son had yet deserted the world. But the sun was fast going down, and even as I gazed upon the wonderful vision, the glory vanished, and the peaks became sad and gray. It was strange to be the only human being at that glacial altitude, and to descend again through a foot of untrodden snow and over sloping sheets of ice into the darkness, and to see the hillsides like a firmament of stars, each showing the place where a solitary man in his hole was delving for silver. The view, as long as I could see it, was quite awful. It looked as if one could not reach Georgetown without tumbling down a precipice. Precipices there were in plenty along the road, skirted with ice to their verge. It was the only ride which required nerve that I have taken in Colorado, and it was long after dark when I returned from my exploit. I left Georgetown at 8 the next morning on the Idaho stage, in glorious cold. In this dry air it is quite warm if there are only a few degrees of frost. The sun does not rise in Georgetown till 11 now. I doubt if it rises there at all in the winter. After 4 hours' fearful bouncing, the baggage car again received us, but this time the conductor, remarking that he supposed I was just traveling to see the country, gave me his chair and put it on the platform, so that I had an excellent view of that truly sublime canyon. For economy, I dined in a restaurant in Golden City, and at 3 remounted my trusty Birdie, intending to arrive here that night. The adventure I met with is almost too silly to tell. When I left Golden City, it was a brilliant summer afternoon, and not too hot. They could not give any directions at the stable, and told me to go out on the Denver track till I met someone who could direct me, which started me off wrong from the first. After riding about 2 miles, I met a man who told me I was all wrong, and directed me across the prairie till I met another, who gave me so many directions that I forgot them, and was irretrievably lost. The afterglow, seen to perfection on the open plain, was wonderful. Just as it grew dark, I rode after a teamster who said I was then 4 miles farther from Boulder than when I left Golden, and directed me to a house 7 miles off. I suppose he thought I should know, for he told me to cross the prairie till I came to a place where 3 tracks are seen, and there to take the best-traveled one, steering all the time by the North Star. His directions did bring me to the tracks, but it was then so dark that I could see nothing, and soon became so dark that I could not even see Birdie's ears, and was lost and benighted. I rode on, hour after hour, in the darkness and solitude, the prairie all around, and a firmament of frosty stars overhead. The prairie wolf howled now and then, and occasionally the lowing of cattle gave me hope of human proximity. But there was nothing but the lone wild plain. You can hardly imagine the longing to see a light, to hear a voice, the intensely eerie feeling of being alone in that vast solitude. It was freezing very sharply, and was very cold, and I was making up my mind to steer all night for the Pole Star, much fearing that I should be brought up by one of the affluents of the Platte, or that Birdie would tire, when I heard the undertoned bellowing of a bull, which from the snorting, rooting up of earth, seemed to be disputing the right of way, and the pony was afraid to pass. While she was scuffling about, I heard a dog bark and a man swear. Then I saw a light, and in another minute found myself at a large house where I knew the people, only 11 miles from Denver. It was nearly midnight, and light, warmth, and a good bed were truly welcome. You can form no idea of what the glory on the plains is just before sunrise. Like the afterglow, for a great height above the horizon, there is a shaded band of the most intense and glowing orange, while the mountains, which reflect the yet unrisen sun, have the purple light of amethysts. I left early, but soon lost the track, and was lost. But knowing that a sublime gash in the mountains was Bear Canyon, quite near Boulder, I struck across the prairie for it, and then found the Boulder track. The best-laid schemes of men and mice gang aft agley, and my exploits came to an untimely end today. On arriving here, instead of going into the mountains, I was obliged to go to bed in consequence of vertigo, headache, and faintness, produced by the intense heat of the sun. In all that weary land, there was no shadow of a great rock under which to rest. The gravelly, baked soil reflected the fiery sun, and it was nearly maddening to look up at the cool blue of the mountains, with their stretches of pines and their deep indigo shadows. Boulder is a hideous collection of frame houses on the burning plain, but it aspires to be a city, in virtue of being a distributing point, for the settlements of the Boulder Canyon, and of the discovery of a coal seam. Longmount, November. I got up very early this morning, and on a hired horse went 9 miles up the Boulder Canyon, which is much extolled, but I was greatly disappointed with everything except its superb wagon road, and much disgusted with the laziness of the horse. A ride of 15 miles across the prairie brought me here early in the afternoon, but of the budget of letters which I expected, there is not one. Bertie looks in such capital condition that my host here can hardly believe that she has traveled over 500 miles. I am feeling the pinch of poverty rather severely. When I have paid my bill here, I shall have exactly 26 cents left. Evans was quite unable to pay the $100 which he owed me, and to save themselves, the Denver banks, though they remain open, have suspended payment, and would not cash my circular notes. The financial straits are very serious, and the unreasoning panic which has set in makes them worse. The present state of matters is, nobody has any money, so nothing is worth anything. The result to me is that nolens volens, I must go up to Estes Park, where I can live without ready money, and remain there till things change for the better. It does not seem a very hard fate. Long's Peak rises in purple gloom, and I long for the cool air and unfettered life of the solitary blue hollow at its base. Estes Park, November 20th. Would that 3 notes of admiration were all I need give to my grand, solitary, uplifted, sublime, remote, beast-haunted lair, which seems more indescribable than ever. But you will wish to know how I have sped, and I wish you to know my present singular circumstances. I left Longmount at 8 on Saturday morning, rather heavily loaded, for in addition to my own luggage, I was asked to carry the mail bag, which was heavy with newspapers. Edwards, with his wife and family, were still believed to be here. A heavy snowstorm was expected, and all the sky, that vast dome which spans the plains, was overcast. But over the mountain it was a deep, still, sad blue, into which snowy peaks rose sunlighted. It was a lonely, mournful-looking morning, but when I reached the beautiful canyon at the St. Vrain, the sad blue became brilliant, and the sun warm and scintillating. Ah, how beautiful and incomparable the ride up here is, infinitely more beautiful than the much-vaunted parts I have seen elsewhere. There is first this beautiful hill-girdled valley of fair savannas, through which the bright St. Vrain curves in and out amidst a tangle of cottonwood and withered clematis and Virginia creeper, which 2 months ago made the valley gay with their scarlet and gold. Then the canyon, with its fantastically stained walls, then the long ascent through sweeping foothills to the gates of rock at a height of 9,000 feet, then the wildest and most wonderful scenery for 20 miles, in which you cross 13 ranges from 9,000 to 11,000 feet high, pass through countless canyons and gulches, cross 13 dark fords, and finally descend through McGinn's Gulch upon this, the gem of the Rocky Mountains. It was a weird ride. I got on very slowly. The road is a hard one for any horse, especially for a heavily loaded one, and at the end of several weeks of severe travel. When I had ridden 15 miles, I stopped at the ranch where people usually get food, but it was empty, and the next was also deserted. So I was compelled to go to the last house, where two young men were balking. There I had to decide between getting a meal for myself or a feed for the pony. But the young man, on hearing of my sore poverty, trusted me till next time. His house, for order and neatness, and a sort of sprightliness of cleanliness, the comfort of cleanliness without its severity, is a pattern to all women, while the clear eyes and manly self-respect, which the habit of total abstinence gives in this country, are a pattern to all men. He cooked me a splendid dinner, with good tea. After dinner, I opened the mailbag, and was delighted to find an accumulation of letters from you. But I sat much too long there, forgetting that I had 20 miles to ride, which could hardly be done in less than 6 hours. It was then brilliant. I had not realized the magnificence of that ride when I took it before, but the pony was tired, and I could not hurry her, and the distance seemed interminable, as after every range I crossed another range. Then came a region of deep, dark, densely wooded gulches, only a few feet wide, and many fords, and from their cold depths I saw the last sunlight fade from the brows of precipices 4,000 feet high. It was eerie, as darkness came on, to wind in and out in the pine-shadowed gloom, sometimes on ice, sometimes in snow, at the bottom of these tremendous chasms. Wolves howled in all directions. This is said to denote the approach of a storm. During this 20-mile ride, I met a hunter with an elk packed on his horse, and he told me not only that the Edwardses were at the cabin yesterday, but that they were going to remain for 2 weeks longer, no matter how uncongenial. The ride did seem endless after darkness came on. Finally, the last huge range was conquered, the last deep chasm passed, and with an eeriness which craved for human companionship, I rode up to Mountain Jim's den. But no light shone through the chinks, and all was silent, so I rode tediously down McGinn's Gulch, which was full of crackings and other strange mountain noises, and was pitch dark, though the stars were bright overhead. Soon I heard the welcome sound of a barking dog. I supposed it to denote strange hunters, but calling Ring at adventure, the noble dog's large paws and grand head were in a moment on my saddle, and he greeted me with all those inarticulate but perfectly comprehensible noises with which dogs welcome their human friends. Of the two men on horses who accompanied him, one was his master, as I knew by the musical voice and grace of manner, but it was too dark to see anyone, though he struck a light to show me the valuable furs with which one of the horses was loaded. The desperado was heartily glad to see me, and sending the man and fur-laden horse on to his cabin, he turned with me to Evans's, and as the cold was very severe, and Bertie was very tired, we dismounted and walked the remaining 3 miles. All my visions of a comfortable reception and good meal after my long ride vanished with his first words. The Edwardses had left for the winter on the previous morning, but had not passed through Longmount. The cabin was dismantled, the stores were low, and the two young men, Mr. Cavan, a miner, and Mr. Buchan, whom I was slightly acquainted with before, were balking there to look after the stock until Evans, who was daily expected, returned. The other settler and his wife had left the park, so there was not a woman within 25 miles. A fierce wind had arisen, and the cold was awful, which seemed to make matters darker. I did not care in the least about myself. I could rough it, and enjoy doing so, but I was very sorry for the young men, who I knew would be much embarrassed by the sudden appearance of a lady for an indefinite time. But the difficulty had to be faced, and I walked in and took them by surprise as they were sitting smoking by the fire in the living room, which was dismantled, unswept, and wretched-looking. The young men did not show any annoyance, but exerted themselves to prepare a meal, and courteously made Jim share it. After he had gone, I boldly confessed my impecunious circumstances, and told them that I must stay there till things changed, that I hoped not to inconvenience them in any way, and that by dividing the work among us they would be free to be out hunting. So we agreed to make the best of it. Our arrangements, which we supposed would last only 2 or 3 days, extended over nearly a month. Nothing could exceed the courtesy and good feeling which these young men showed. It was a very pleasant time on the whole, and when we separated they told me that though they were much taken aback at first, they felt at last that we could get on in the same way for a year, in which I cordially agreed. Sundry practical difficulties had to be faced and overcome. There was one of the common spring mattresses of the country in the little room which opened from the living room, but nothing upon it. This was remedied by making a large bag and filling it with hay. Then there were neither sheets, towels, nor tablecloths. This was irremediable, and I never missed the first or last. Candles were another loss, and we had only one paraffin lamp. I slept all night in spite of a gale, which blew all Sunday and into Monday afternoon, threatening to lift the cabin from the ground, and actually removing part of the roof from the little room between the kitchen and the living room, in which we used to dine. Sunday was brilliant, but nearly a hurricane, and I dared not stir outside the cabin. The parlor was 2 inches deep in the mud from the roof. We nominally divided the cooking. Mr. Cavan makes the best bread I ever ate. They bring in wood and water and wash the supper things, and I do my room and the parlor, wash the breakfast things and number of etceteras. My room is easily done, but the parlor is a never-ending business. I have swept shovelfuls of mud out of it 3 times today. There is nothing to dust it with but a buffalo's tail, and every now and then a gust descends the open chimney and drives the wood ashes all over the room. However, I have found an old shawl which answers for a tablecloth, and have made our parlor look a little more habitable. Jim came in yesterday in a silent mood, and sat looking vacantly into the fire. The young men said that this mood was the usual precursor of an ugly fit. Food is a great difficulty. Of 30 milch cows, only one is left, and she does not give milk enough for us to drink. The only meat is some pickled pork, very salt and hard, which I cannot eat, and the hens lay less than 1 egg a day. Yesterday morning I made some rolls and made the last bread into a bread-and-butter pudding, which we all enjoyed. Today I found part of a leg of beef hanging in a wagon shed, and we were elated with the prospect of fresh meat. But on cutting into it, we found it green and unedible. Had it not been for some tea which was bestowed upon me at the inn at Longmount, we should have had none. In this superb air and physically active life, I can eat everything but pickled pork. We breakfast about 9, dine at 2, and have supper at 7, but our menu never varies. Today I have been all alone in the park, as the men left to hunt elk after breakfast, after bringing in wood and water. The sky is brilliant, and the light intense, or else the solitude would be oppressive. I keep 2 horses in the corral, so as to be able to explore, but except Birdie, who is turned out, none of the animals are worth much now from want of shoes and tender feet. End of letter 13.
That's the average number of apps used by many companies. This leads to a lot of context and tab switching that drains employee focus and costs your company. Grammarly can help. Grammarly's AI works in over 500,000 apps and websites, making it easy for your team to write clearly and on brand without disrupting workflow. Join 70,000 teams who save an average of $5,000 per employee per year using Grammarly. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.